The Guardian.
Guardian podcasts are partnered with audible.co.uk. For a free download, be sure to check out guardian.co.uk/audible, where Guardian listeners can choose any audiobook for free. See the page for more details.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Time is a gift given to you,
given to give you the time you need.
The time you need to have the time of your life.
Follow Butch Patrick on a fantastic trip through the Phantom Toll Booth, where nothing is real but your imagination. To Dictionopolis, where words are weird.
Words in a word are fantastic. You can hint them, you can say them, you can print them, you can pray them, emphasize them, and despise them.
The only thing you can do easily is be wrong, and that's hardly worth the effort.
For Milo, who has plenty of time, one genuine turnpike toll booth for use by those who have never traveled to the land beyond. If bored, pull tab.
There was once a boy named Milo who didn't know what to do with himself, not just sometimes, but always. When he was in school, he longed to be out, and when he was out, he longed to be in. On the way, he thought about coming home, and coming home, he thought about going. Wherever he was, he wished he was somewhere else. And when he got there, he wondered why he bothered.
The most important reason for going from one place to another is to see what's in between, and they took great pleasure in doing just that.
Whether or not you find your own way, you're bound to find some way. If you happen to find my way, please return it, as it was lost years ago. I imagine by now it's quite rusty.
So where do you think those quotes are from? Alice in Wonderland? Think again, this time in an American accent.
I'm going to read you a selection from The Phantom Tollbooth, and it's one that happens throughout the book where ordinary ideas and things that you think you understand are turned around backwards. And this is a section where Milo and his friends are in the in Digitopolis, the land of numbers, and they've just arrived very hungry. "Perhaps you'd care for something to eat," said the math magician, offering each of them a heaping bowlful. "Yes, sir," said Milo, who was beside himself with hunger. "Thank you," added Tok. The humbug made no reply, for he was already too busy eating. And in a moment, the three of them had finished absolutely everything they'd been given. "Please have another portion," said the math magician, filling their bowls once more. And as quickly as they'd finished the first one, the second was emptied too. "Don't stop now," he insisted, serving them again and again and again and again. "How very strange," thought Milo as he finished his seventh helping. "Each one I eat makes me a little hungrier than the one before." "Do have some more," suggested the math magician, and they continued to eat just as fast as he filled the plates. After Milo had eaten 9 portions, Tok 11, and the humbug, without once stopping to look up, 23, the math magician blew his whistle, and immediately the pot was removed, and all the miners went back to work. "Ugh," gasped the bug, suddenly realizing that he was 23 times hungrier than when he started. "I think I'm starving." "Me too," complained Milo, whose stomach felt as empty as he could remember, "and I ate so much." "Yes, it was delicious, wasn't it?" agreed the pleased dodecahedron, wiping the gravy from several of his mouths. "It's the specialty of the kingdom, subtraction stew." "I have more of an appetite than when I began," said Tok. "Certainly," replied the mathematician. "What did you expect? The more you eat, the hungrier you get. Everyone knows that." "They do," said Milo doubtfully. "Then how do you ever get enough?" "Enough," he said impatiently. "Here in Digitopolis, we have our meals when we're full, and we eat until we're hungry. That way, when you don't have anything at all, you have more than enough. It's a very economical system. You must have been quite stuffed to have eaten so much."
Yes, it's the one and only Norton Juster. His 1961 novel, The Phantom Tollbooth, has indeed been compared to Lewis Carroll's Alice. Though he published this best-known of his works more than half a century ago, he's still on the road talking about it to children whose grandparents were its first readers. Michel Pauly caught up with him on a recent UK visit.
Listening to your reading there, the book still sounds incredibly fresh, and it's hard to believe that it's now over 50 years old. It's got a timeless quality to it.
I think it's very simple that a lot of things change in the world, but children don't change much because they confront, as young children, the same questions, the same things they don't understand, the same things that terrify them or make them feel like they don't understand anything. And those questions, you know, the vocabulary may change, the costumes may change, the hardware changes, but children remain very much the same. And they understand there are a lot of things that they simply don't understand yet. And they understand something that I discovered quite early that terrified me, was that they don't understand grown-ups, and grown-ups don't understand them. A lot of things get turned around backwards in the book because that's the way children make themselves understand things. So I love the juxtaposition of phantom and tollbooth because they're two words you would never put together in any logical way, and I just like that. But then I started to think, okay, well, it's not necessary for it to be a tollbooth. It could have been anything. I was not thinking about this when I was writing the book, but I thought about it later. The point I was trying to make was that almost everybody in the world at some point in their lives will have an experience or a vision or something that's very different from anything they have thought about before. In effect, opens up a whole new vista in their lives. The only, you know, word that even begins to approach that is epiphany. That's what it is. Now, a lot of the times these happen and people don't pay attention to them, or they forget them, or they don't realize it's that important for them or what. But that's the kind of thing that changes you. When you see something, you meet someone, you read something, or something happens that makes you a different person than your level of understanding. I remember talking to a group of kids about this, and I explained it all as best I could, and I knew there were probably about 50 or 60 of them in this room. I knew there were maybe two or three of them who understood at that point, because they were young, what I was talking about. But the other thing I know, one of the things I learned teaching, and I taught for 32 years, is that what I'm teaching and what they're learning rarely coincide. And planting these things in a way that may be over their head, things happen later. I get a lot of calls and mail from ex-students who'll say to me something like, do you remember what we were talking about? I understand that now. And I think that's the essence of good teaching. You plant stuff. You're not planting beans and getting beans.
Have reactions to the book changed at all? You must get loads of letters
from
children. I do,
and I do a lot of signings, and it's very interesting to me. I remember one recently where I looked up, and there was three generations standing in front of me, the grandparents, the parents, and the kids, all holding their books out to be signed, because it seems to hang around. People like to read it at different... I'll get a letter sometimes from someone who's nine, saying they'll write and tell me the usual children's letter, I'm nine, this is what I like, this is the questions I have, so forth. And then... about 5 years later, I'll get a second letter. Now they're about 14 and they're in high school, as we call it. And they'll write a letter all about the book again. And it's almost as if they're talking about another book because they're getting a whole lot of things that they didn't understand before. I've had a number of them where I'll get a third or an even a fourth letter when they're in college or even out. I remember I got one letter, obviously, from a little girl in the United States who was Hispanic. And she wanted to know why all the princesses in the books that she reads, including the Phantom Tollbooth, had blonde and blue-eyed princesses. I felt terrible about that because it was what I had given to me when I was a child, and it just passed through without me thinking about it. Teachers, I don't know how they are here in this country, but back in the United States, seem to me, just don't listen enough to kids. They're always telling you what you're supposed to be thinking or understanding. It's very simple. What you understand from what you read is what's important.
And the book is all about learning, isn't it? But that makes it sound very serious.
Yes,
and very dull.
I try to avoid. It's not a tract. I wasn't trying to teach a lesson or anything. I was doing it because they were things that I got back to myself, not specific instances or episodes of my life, but the way I used to feel about things. And that whole business of not understanding adults and they not me. I remember that one of the things my parents were endlessly saying to me when we would have an argument and I'd present my viewpoint and they would say very calmly, well, how can you be right and the rest of the world wrong? And it took me a number of years before I realized that that was true, that I was right and the rest of the world was wrong.
The book came about in quite an unexpected way. I understand it started out as a book about urban planning,
yes.
Which seems unlikely.
I had studied architecture. My father was an architect, and my brother was, and I always loved to make things. It would never seem to be an issue. That was what I was going to do, and I loved the whole idea of it. Finished architectural school. I came here, actually, on a Fulbright. From there, I went into service in the Navy, then back to New York, and I took a job in an architectural office. And frankly, so much had happened in my life, I really wasn't ready to do much of anything, and I decided, gee, it might be fun to do a book on cities for children. And I started on this, and within a few weeks, I realized this is really not what I want to do at this time. And so I took a vacation and said, I've got to get away and think about something else for a while till I decide what I can do. And I visited some friends who had a beach house and took long walks in the sand and had a little notebook with me. And I started to scribble down what I thought was a story, a very short little story about me as a child who didn't like school, wasn't particularly interested in learning, at least learning the way I got it at school. And it just began to grow.
And the relationship with Jules Pfeiffer?
We met quite accidentally. The last stationing I had was at the Brooklyn Navy Yard in New York, and I found a basement room in some terrible little house in Brooklyn Heights, but it was lovely because it was mine. And quite accidentally, Jules lived on the second floor, and we met, and we both hit it off very well, and that's how it started. And then we took a bigger apartment, a kind of duplex apartment, at the other end of the Brooklyn Heights, which was not very fixed up yet, and moved in together with a third friend of ours. And I was working on the book, and I pace when I work, and he was living on the floor below, and he would come up because I was driving him crazy. And then he took some of the pages away, and he began doing these wonderful pictures. And just everything, it was accidental, and everything happened because we didn't know how to do it. I had never written a book. He had never illustrated a children's book. And I think everything good that happened was because of that.
And yet after the success of the book, you weren't tempted to become a full-time writer or children's book writer. You carried on as an architect.
Well, for a long time, I was running a parallel course, really. I had an architectural office. I was also teaching, and I had the writing. And there were times when if things happened all at once, it was very difficult to deal with. But it worked out fine. And now that I've retired from the architecture and the teaching, and now I finish my breakfast, walk up a flight of stairs, and I'm in my office.
But you said that architecture shapes how you see the world.
Oh, no question.
And how does that fit in with your writing?
When I write, I have to visualize things, and that's part of the architectural training. And the other thing in the architectural training, what it does for you is make you see things from different points of view. In other words, you'll get an idea for a scheme or a design project that you're working on. And almost the first thing you will do, or I do, is say to myself, okay, that's one way. Now, if I look at it exactly opposite, what would it be? And you'd investigate all these different ways. For kids, too, we tend to overemphasize reading. And it's the pictures. A young child will make his world or her world through pictures and images and through other sensory things. But the pictures and images are very, very important. And I think that's the way they create what I like to think of as an armature for everything they then learn through the words.
Do you think there's a problem, though, that kids can be too overloaded with images, for instance, with television and
yeah, because that's a passive relationship, though, the television. I find that very different. Sometimes when I'm in a classroom, I'll do a little exercise with kids and say, okay, I'll start a story, and then we'll go around the room and you'll all add a piece to it. But what you get back from them now is almost exactly what you can hear on television. All the stories, all the images, everything are from what they see on the television screen and tend to be very scary and sometimes very upsetting. But when you're conjuring pictures yourself, I used to be a habituated radio listener when I was a kid, and there would be stories on, and all the images were ones that I had to manufacture in my own head. And that's very creative. It's very different.
I don't know if you still have this, but you had a very different way of looking at things as a child because of, very hard to say this,
synesthesia, which I did not know the name of until I was an adult. I couldn't do arithmetic or mathematical problems or anything without assigning colors to numbers. I could not comprehend numbers without the colors. That's just one aspect of synesthesia, but people do it with sounds, with other kinds of things too, where they'll sort of meld two different ways of looking at something so they can create an understanding. And then that understanding is very much askew from the way most people understand things. So it leads you very naturally into, I don't know how you describe it. You can say it's a creative approach or approach that's just different. And so a lot of other things happen that don't normally happen to you. And it was kind of a blessing in disguise, I think.
It seems like in the book you touch on this with the idea that words taste of things.
You assign to something a whole series of characteristics that you normally wouldn't think about. Mm. And so it's great fun. And I love words. My father was an addicted punster and wordplay person. I'd walk in the door and he'd look at me very seriously and say, "Aha, I see you're coming early since lately. Used to be behind before, but now you're first at last." I had no idea what he was talking about. And he would see it, and he'd get up, put his arm around me, and say, "You're a good kid, and I'd like to see you get ahead. You need one." But when you come home every single day, and someone is there throwing these things at you, as a kid, your first reaction is always, "Ugh," because you don't understand it, or what to do with it. But after a while, slowly you do, and when one of these is thrown at you, you say, "I understand that, and I can do that." And so there's a whole new world opens for you. But words are music. I mean, if I go into a classroom and say, "Okay, how many of you have ever said a word over and over again until it had no meaning? It was just sounds." Virtually every hand in the room will go up because every kid has done that. And so the idea of playing with language through the sounds, even the pace, the music, the rhythm of it, adds great ways to you to express things, you know, in a book. And so I love doing that. And of course, it's a disease that is easily caught and you never get rid of it. One of the things I always enjoyed doing as a child, and I still do as an adult, is seeing what happens if you use words or phrases literally. And so the book, of course, as jumping to conclusions now, for most people, that's a thing you toss off and never think twice about. There's one in the book that I'm especially fond of because it was a thing that my mother always said. When something was obvious or you didn't have to think of it, she would just simply toss off, "Well, that goes without saying." And so when they are going to the royal banquet in the Dictionopolis, they all get into a little wagon and someone says, "Shh, it goes without saying." And off they go. And kids love that kind, because they've all heard all these kinds of sayings and things. But here again, the distortion of language just opens up opportunities and extends levels of meaning in a terrific way.
Milo enters a world where he sees two opposing forces, words and numbers, Digitopolis and Dictionopolis. Where did that come from? Are you a words man or a numbers man?
I have to confess I'm both, which I think is the only logical position you can take. But I remembered years before I started working on the book, I read a book by an English author named C.P. Snow, called The Two Cultures, I think it was called. I don't know whether you can classify it as words and numbers then, but the humanities and the arts and the sciences, which always seem to be at each other's throats. And I thought that would be a wonderful thing, again, of putting him in a position where he has to face this issue on his terms. And so I began, you know, writing things about that. And it goes right through the book until the very end, where when he and Princesses Rhyme and Reason are rescued and everybody disperses to go back to where they are, King Azaz, the Unabridged, and the Mathemagician walk off together, and almost under their breath as they're walking off, they start the argument again. Numbers are more important. Words are more important. And so you know that that conflict is going to be there always. Now, the hardest thing is to use things like that and not try to teach something, but try to use that so people will begin to make conclusions on their own. And that's, I think, one of the things that children's books do and adult books don't do enough. So.
Norton Juster there talking about The Phantom Tollbooth, which has just celebrated its 50th anniversary. Phantom Tollbooth leaps, soars and abounds in right notes all over the place, as any proper masterpiece must, wrote another old master in his introduction to the 35th anniversary edition. He was none other than Maurice Sendak, whose death last week had wild things the world over gnashing their terrible teeth and roaring their terrible roars.
The night Max wore his wolf suit and made mischief of one kind. and another. His mother called him Wild Thing, and Max said, "I'll eat you up." So he was sent to bed without eating anything. And then there's a picture of Max with a hammer nailing a cloth into the wall, and there's a bear strung up, I assume murdered, maybe a suicide. Anyway, he chases a dog with a fork. I don't think he's really going to eat him, but kids are jerks, you know. And the bedside table is a bush now, and grew until his ceiling hung with vines, and the walls became the world all around.
Wild Things the world over, gnashing their terrible teeth and roaring their terrible roars. And one of them is with us here in the studio today. He's the poet, novelist and broadcaster Michael Rosen. Sure. Well, we've actually brought you here to talk about Edward Lear, whose bicentenary it is. But it just struck me it's perfectly possible to trace a lineage going all the way from Lear through to those Wild Things, and indeed through to your own We're Going on a Bear Hunt.
Yes, I think the thing you have to remember about children's books is that one division you can make in them is between the books that are very cosy and reassure us, and there's nothing wrong with that, reassure parents, reassure children, and those that take risks. And you could definitely say of the three books or three authors that you're talking about, they take risks. So going back to Edward Lear, this was someone who disrupted things in two main ways. One, he disrupted bodies, and the other was he disrupted words. He played around with them. And then if we come right before to Maurice Sendak, I mean, here was somebody who dared suggest, this was the real thing that is tricky, is he dared suggest that somehow or other childhood or being a child could be difficult, or that you might have feelings that you could express within the children's book, feelings that mostly people try to suppress or repress in children. So if you think of Max, he's very, very angry. Well, in very conventional terms, when children get angry, what you tell them is shush and be quiet and stop it and grow up and stop being childish and things like that. And instead, he gives rein to it. And again, in The Night Kitchen, he gives rein to the child's, quote, silly fears, unquote. Instead of saying they're silly fears, he gives them air and space. So, yeah, there are some authors who've made it possible for the rest of us to do dangerous, edgy things.
Edward Lear was born in 1812, and the received wisdom now is that childhood was invented by the Victorians. To what extent was he responsible for the invention of childhood?
Yeah, he certainly thought there was a division between adults and children because of the way in which he behaved that we know. I mean, he first started playing around with verses that were suitable for children when he was being employed as a painter. He had already painted exotic birds and had become very famous for it. And so the Earl of Derby, well, it was in fact Lord Stanley, who was going to be the Earl of Derby, up in Knowsley, had hired him to paint his own rather exotic menagerie of animals and beasts. But he kept disappearing. And not only did he keep disappearing, but the children did. The children seemed to be sort of disappearing at dinner when they were supposed to be all sitting there. And it seems they were going downstairs to the steward's room and being entertained. And he was doing drawings and telling them jokey little stories and beginning to play around with limericks. So you can see that there's already a differentiation, if you like, in his understanding. And he wrote at the time that he was fed up with all these rather stuffy people, and what he would love to do is hop along the corridor on one leg. In a way, that's really what most of the poems at that stage, they are. They're these strange beings, the young person of Pinner or that funny old man of Peru and that sort of thing. And they're all doing what he obviously would have liked to have done if he hadn't been constrained in the way everyone around him was being constrained. Because you could argue that the key change that happens at the beginning of the 19th century is that it's thought that in the 18th century they literally unbuttoned their blouses, quite literally, and that the Victorians, you can see physically what they've done, is they've put on very tight waistcoats and stuck women in very tight corsets and made sure that no part of their front could be shown. And you can just see it in the paintings.
Are the limericks actually written for children originally?
Those were the people he was reading them with and for. Yes, that's right. I mean, when a book comes out in Victorian times, it's not
quite as clear as it is nowadays, that we, you know, we have children's publishers and adult publishers, and then you have crossover books, if you like, and then they change the cover of a Philip Pullman or a J.K. Rowling, and then they say, oh, look, it's now published for adults. They had juvenile libraries, as they sometimes used to call it. If you look at the back of 19th century books, and you can see these lists of books, and they're quite often quite cheap, shoddy little books that were printed. And it was, and there were children's bookshops. You know, there was one in Bond Street and so on that people knew. But then there was another whole set of books, some of which are classics that we read. I mean, if you just take Alice, for example, and when you look at the very first editions of them, there's nothing to indicate that it's for children. And then they would get reviews and people would say, this marvellous book about a child, there are many children who would like this. I think adults have always been able to read that book and enjoy it and find what nonsense is about.
It's interesting that you wrote a wonderful appreciation of Edward Lear for us on The Guardian. And one of the people who commented on it said, The Owl and the Pussycat must be one of the finest love poems in the English language.
If you want to sort of be hyper-rational about it, which of course is always a bit dangerous around nonsense, but let's just say for a moment, well, first of all, The Owl and the Pussycat, well, they're not of the same species, are they? He also doesn't actually say which one is male and which one is female. There is no he or she. Now, you might make assumptions that somebody who strums a guitar and says,
My lovely pussy,
yes, of course, there's a slightly different meaning these days, that, you know, that the owl is male and the pussy, but there is, doesn't say so. And then the other thing they do is they elope. Now, elopement in Victorian times was a serious, serious business. I mean, you know, you had to throw away all convention to do it. They haven't gone away on a honeymoon. They go away in order to get married. And also, he's also made the minister or the vicar Turkey. And of course, Turkish traditionally talk nonsense. They go, blah, 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 blah. So there's all sorts of mysterious things about it. So yes, in a way it is. It is a glorious love poem because two people who are not at first suited to each other appear to have gone away, and then they've found absolute pure love, and they're dancing by the light of the moon. So yes, it is. It's a, you know, it is a very pure love poem.
Would you like to read it to us?
Well, why not? Let's have a go. The owl and the pussycat went to sea in a beautiful pea-green boat. They took some honey and plenty of money wrapped up in a £5 note. The owl looked up to the stars above and sang to a small guitar. Oh, lovely pussy, oh, pussy, my love. What a beautiful pussy you are, you are, you are. What a beautiful pussy you are. Pussy said to the owl, you elegant fowl, how charmingly sweet you sing. Oh, let us be married. Too long we have tarried. But what shall we do for a ring? They sailed away for a year and a day to the land where the bong tree grows. And there in a wood a piggywig stood with a ring at the end of his nose, his nose, his nose, with a ring at the end of his nose. Dear pig, are you willing to sell for 1 shilling your ring? Said the piggy, I will. So they took it away and were married next day by the turkey who lives on the hill. They dined on mince and slices of quince, which they ate with a runcible spoon. And hand in hand, on the edge of the sand, they danced by the light of the moon, the moon, the moon. They danced by the light of the moon.
So lovely. Now, Mike, there's one interesting thing about that, which is I always thought there were two reprises of the moon, and you are, and there are three. And I know this is something you've picked me up on before in relation to your own work, that I've got the scansion completely wrong. And I bet lots of people say, what a beautiful piggy yeah. You are,
yes,
pussy, what a beautiful pussy yes. You are.
I mean, the thing about Lear was that with his scansion and his metrics, he was, by and large, absolutely perfect. I mean, it does pose a tiny little problem when you read it. You could say, they dance by the light of the moon, they dance by the light of the moon. That would work. So he has squeezed in another one. They dance by the light of the moon, the moon. You've got to do something with those other two moons. And the way he lays it out on the page, he's telling you to do that.
In your appreciation, you wrote that he was the voice of ever-wandering creatures. What do you mean by that? And who are those creatures?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. If you look at the poems that tend to get called the Grombulian poems, these are the poems like the Jumblies and the Dong with a Luminous Nose and the Pobble with No Toes and so on. There's a melancholy balladry. And if you notice, they're all venturers. They all go off and do things and they're wandering around. Quite often, in either a fairly pointless, odd sort of a way, a bit like the Jumblies, or on some sort of trip of unrequited love or unrequited hope. Lear himself, I mean, his life was quite extraordinary. I mean, here's somebody who suffered. He suffered mentally and physically. We have to say he was a kind of refugee or exile. I mean, when you look at his life, almost every year, he travelled, and he didn't just travel around the British Isles. I mean, he travelled far, far. He travelled right the way across the Mediterranean, across North Africa and so on. Anyway, he just was never-endingly travelling, and in the end became an exile anyway. He lived in San Remo in Italy. So, in a way, another way to see him is as somebody on the move. Now, psychologists these days call this in flight. That's to say that he was both physically and mentally in flight from something. Now, he had to hide away his epilepsy. He talked about it in to himself, as it were, but he hid it. He hid it from everybody else. Epilepsy is incredibly scary for the person who has it because they know what it looks like if people, intimate people, have told them. And then he, either linked to it or otherwise, he suffered from depression and he was wise and clever enough to have a name for it, which he called the morbids. One way or another, he obviously found it very difficult to love people, or if he did, he didn't know how to say so. And anyway, he doesn't ever seem to have received love from anybody once his sister died, which was when I think he was in his very early 20s.
Now, one of the events of this year is to put up a plaque to him.
And there's a green one in his birthplace. His birthplace, rather wonderfully, I think, as somebody who lived on the Holloway Road for nearly a year, is just off the Holloway Road, where Seven Sisters Road leaves the Holloway Road. There's a little tiny corner there with the name Bowman's Terrace, I think it is, and there was a villa, and that was where his mother and father had 21 children, of whom he was the 20th.
I'm going to talk us through some of the events that are coming up or have come up during the year, because as a way of illustrating the variety of him, some of these things we've touched on. So you've mentioned that he was born in Islington, and there is a celebration with you, in fact, in Islington of him.
Yes, that's right. I mean, Islington is a very strange and mysterious place, very diverse and so on. And so, yes, on the 29th of May, at a place called Platform, and I think children are involved in that.
And there is also in Corfu opening this month, there's an exhibition of his watercolours, drawings and engravings of his ornithological drawings, which we've touched on a little bit.
On the ornithological ones, and he was, I think, you know, when you look at his paintings of exotic birds and animals, you can see, without an expert telling you, that these are quite extraordinary. They are beyond photograph. They are kind of hyper-real. There's a sort of glowing quality about them, and they stare out of the page at you, and a part of you can't help think that this is almost Edward Lear staring at you as these great parrots and lemurs and so on, with their eyes very slightly exaggerated and glaring, and you have a funny feeling that it's kind of Edward Lear tucked inside these exotic creatures. But I understand that the experts regard him as perhaps the world's second greatest painter of exotic birds, the first being Audubon. But his watercolours are absolutely magnificent. I really love them.
And they're landscape.
They're riverscapes, more often than not. He loved water. And so, for example, if you go to the National Maritime Museum, you can get a beautiful little edition of the ones that they hold there. Yes.
But now just moving on, in Lincoln, running now, there's an exhibition about his illustrations of Tennyson's poetry, which we haven't touched on at all.
No, that's right. Well, you see, what he wanted to be was to be a famous artist. That's what he most wanted to be. What he wanted to do was paint these huge canvases, perhaps gothic stroke romantic, you know, the sense of a great big landscape that has got inner depths and somehow or other the soul is represented. And actually, they're great big, dull, smudgy things. But obviously, artists and writers and so on did come to him in his own time, and Tennyson was one of them, yeah.
Now, in Bristol, there's a reprise of an event that's happened, actually, at the British Library already, which is about his epilepsy. And it's happening at the Bridge Foundation for Psychotherapy and the Arts.
Yes.
Is he one of these artists who gets held up as a case study, psychological case study?
Because people are very interested in our perceptions of illness. Because if you said, look at his verse, it's written by an epileptic, you could say that these poems are often about people who've lost control of their bodies. Their bodies, things are happening. They're getting rolled up, that elastic old man of Pinner, or that unfortunate man of Peru or whatever. And because they've been steamrolled or broken apart in some way or another. So you could say that's a refracted form of an attitude to epilepsy.
Lear is just one of several people who are celebrating bicentenaries. We've just had Browning. We've, of course, had Dickens. Everybody's been on and on about Dickens. How important is he? How highly does he rank in this pantheon?
In a way, you've got to put that question into the context of how we view children's literature. The problem is that in all canons and pantheons in this country, children's literature, it doesn't even really get on to the first rung of the ladder. You know, I know this because I try to teach children's literature at a university level and find it incredibly difficult to get anybody to take it seriously. Children's literature is so ringed with yes buts, and well, of course, it is restrained or restricted and constrained by the fact that they can't say this and they can't say that, and it is an inherently conservative form because you can't suggest that somehow or other human beings are going into permanent decline, or you can't suggest that the world can fall apart or anything like that. And so we can't possibly take it seriously. So the problem with poor old Lear is that he's cast in the role as being a children's poet, and that's it. He's doomed, isn't he? We've got a hierarchy about what we think of as great. We don't say, what matters to me? And also it's an attitude to childhood. Because, you know, put away, leave behind you those childish things. The whole idea about adulthood is that we've matured, we've become better than we were when we were children. That's one hat. And then on the other hand, you find people are spending globally millions of pounds going to go and see people to discover or try and reenact their childhood in order to find out why they're screwed up. I mean, that said, I think the tributes that people have made to Maurice Sendak in particular, to bring it back to Maurice, are very moving and very kind and very gracious. And I think that's good. I think in some way or another, people could see that Sendak was someone with serious intent. I think with Lear, there's a bit of a problem that they can't find the serious intent. It just looks like endless frippery. I don't think it is. I think if you disrupt the world in the ways he was, that's a very serious and important thing to do. I think Sendak's got on his side, if you like, the Freudians. He's got helping him. The fact that what you're looking at in a Sendak book are the reenactments of Freudian analysis, but done in such a beautiful and symbolic and accessible way that we don't go, oh, look, there's the ego struggling with the id. We don't say that. We just go, there's a little boy taming the wild things. Do you see what I mean? So that's fine, but there's a sense of seriousness about it that we can decode. I think the problem with Lear is that he's doomed by the fact that he is, if you like, more playful.
A was once an apple pie. Pidey, widey, tidy, pidey, nice insidey, apple pie.
The pobble who has no toes had once as many as we. When they said, someday you may lose them all, he replied, fish, fiddle-dee-dee.
B was once a little bear. Beary, wary, scary, hairy, takey, carey, little bear.
And his Aunt Jobiska made him drink lavender water tinged with pink. For he said, the world in general knows there's nothing so good for a pobble's toes. The pobble who has
was
no
once a little skank, cakey, bakey, makey, cakey,
but before
cakey,
he
cakey,
out, he wrapped his nose like this.
Don't forget to start your free 14-day trial of audible.co.uk and to download your free audiobook. Head to guardian.co.uk/audible.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.